It's obviously is a very well-known outfit. It's kind of been used to publicize the whole exhibition here.
Absolutely.
So could you talk us through this a bit?
Yes. What's interesting here is that for some weird reason, this outfit is always known as Rite of Spring, but actually Kansai called it Tokyo Pop Kabuki Jumpsuit. And this is the outfit actually that greets you when you walk into the V&A exhibition. And it is the Hikinuki outfit, which Hikinuki means to remove quickly. So when the assistants would help him and remove it, it had a tearaway inner red lining, and you would just pull that off the person.
So this whole thing rips off.
Yeah, it rips off.
A kind of early version of Bucks Fizz.
But when he's got it on, and he and Bowie has said this, it's tight, is uncomfortable, is because it's a thick kind of plastic that Kansai. I mean, how you could even sew it on with a sewing machine is a miracle to me. But he made a thick zigzag stitch to accentuate those lines. And it's really, shall we say, you know, not a loungewear type of outfit. It's cumbersome, and it serves its purpose, and it's very dramatic. But it is, tight, heavy, and then but once it's removed, he's released from the outfit, and so, yeah.
And this is a no costume.
This is a no costume. And what I wanted to show here was, even though Kabuki was the direct inspiration, even as stated by Kansai, and well-known fact, that no costuming, I believe, also had a great influence on Kansai, even if it was, again, an unconscious process. The materials, the volume, and just, again, he's wearing the hakama under here, and that's the effect of this when he puts his legs together. It looks like a one, even though it's rounded on the outer side, whereas this is square. And also, the idea of ghostliness and liminality, that's what the no is all about, just sort of the world between this one and the other. And I think Bowie perfectly personifies that. So there is, I think a great deal of no play influence in the work as well.
And could you, just for people who are less familiar with Japanese theatrical traditions, could you explain the difference between kabuki and no theater?
Sure. The kabuki is a theater form that, if for want of a better explanation, is more like a soap opera or pop culture. You go, it's a very long ordeal, but it's fascinating. Many costume changes, stage changes, colorful, dramatic, overdone, really wonderful. The no is a more subdued, slow-moving, the intonation of poetry almost, and almost in a sense like channeling or going into another world, particularly when seen by firelight at night. It was reserved traditionally for viewing by the aristocrats or the very educated. Kabuki was always the theater of the masses, so they're very different in that sense. And no is also a particularly Japanese theater form, whereas kabuki is rooted in Chinese opera and Chinese theater. So it is very different, but both very integral to Japanese theater arts. Yeah.
I lived in Japan for a short time, quite a few years ago, and one of the first things I was taken to was a production of a no play. And I don't think anything else could have been quite so drastically different from anything I'd ever seen before. It was a real kind of, it really epitomized the kind of culture shock that I was feeling.
Absolutely,
being there.
Absolutely. And I might add one other thing. In the archive here, I found that a lot of UK newspapers and magazines at the time kept emphasizing that Kansai had designed all these Bowie outfits based on no plays. So you see, again, something got into the consciousness that communicated that fact, when in point of fact, it was more literally and definitely kabuki, but I would say no also did. Actually, they were right to state that, because it did have an influence.
Right. And so moving on to makeup, which is kind of pretty much as important as the costume in Bowie's performances. So could you talk us through this?
Absolutely. This is an image of the famous kabuki onagata, or the man who plays the woman's role in the kabuki theater, because all the roles in the kabuki theater are played by men, but there are those who specialize particularly in doing the woman's role, and that's what the onagata is. And this is the most famous exponent of that, and that is Tamasaburo Bando, who I was privileged to work with for a year, and he really is great.
And so this is a man?
Yes. This is a man. And he's just beautiful and incredible. And he did teach David Bowie how to apply kabuki makeup. But as Lindsay Kemp has noted, who also learned there, that would have taken quite many years to really get it perfected. So I'm sure he taught him, he said, the basics, but to really get it right, you need a lot of time and patience. But all of Bowie's makeup items came from Japan. He was using rice powder, He was using the rouge from there, you know, because you can't get those things, couldn't get those things here at the time, or even still really can't. And so you could see a sort of facsimile, even though this isn't the best picture in the sense, it kind of shows more the accentuation of the reddening of the face, which you also see in Kabuki and with the Onogata, you can see that. But Bowie also put this third eye emblem. You don't see that in the Kabuki, but I think that was his own take on accentuation of Buddhism because he had been such a great student of Buddhism and the third eye notion, the all-seeing eye, because that's where the nen or consciousness is located. And the hair, well, we'll get to that, I guess, or I don't know, will we get to the hair or should
Let's talk about the hair now.
The hair is actually, Susie Fussy is credited with being the hairdresser there, and she did that, but it was based on a Yamamoto Kansai model's hair color and cut that Bowie had seen, inspired by that, and then wanted it. So that's a modified version of a Kabuki lion dance wig, which you will see in the Kabuki. And also you will see in the no play, there's a lion dance, which is a bit more elongated, but yeah, it's a similar aesthetic. The bright red color, sort of chopped off appearance, and yeah, it's coming from Yamamoto Kansai.
And this lion character, does that have the same sort of significance that it would have in sort of
Yes, something powerful, something very almost aggressive, and yeah, it does. And there were no lions in Japan, per se, so it makes it even more exotic. So the idea of exoticism, yeah.
Right, yeah. Okay. And this character of the Onogata seems to be really quite central to Bowie's self-creation,
yes.
Androgyny, or
yes.
themes that people continuously reference
yes.
when discussing Bowie and his performance.
Yes.
And this was something that came from Lindsay Kemp and also from Kansai Yamamoto, so it was really central.
I think so. And also, what's not mentioned is that in the theater tradition of Japan, aside from the androgynous character of the kabuki, there was also a tradition of women who are playing all men's roles. There are women-only troupes, theater troupes, such as the Takurazuka. And when you see those androgynous characters, you can't tell if it's a boy or a girl. And so I think that tradition is inherent in Japanese theater arts.
And is that the female playing male, is that quite a current contemporary thing, or does it have as long a tradition as
it,
this sort of
It basically began in the early 20th century. It was established like in the 1913 or so in Takurazuka, which is more near Osaka. And it's to this day an extremely popular art theater form in Japan. Women just flock to these things. They're groupies for these women who play the men's roles. Mm. And so there are great books written about it. And so to me, it's both the influence of the androgynous aspect of the human being as portrayed in theater arts in Japan, whether Kabuki or the Takurazuka contemporary. For example, to put a little more background onto it, a spin, homosexuality in Japan was something that was part of the samurai culture, and it's not such a foreign concept, and there's much research done on that, and Lindsay Kemp was gay, and I think that also that came through to David Bowie, so, and they were lovers, obviously, for a time, so yeah, there are many influences that were at work here. I might want to add, I don't know if you can see much of it, but this kimono that was designed by Kansai, again, white, and with this pine tree motif, which represents longevity, also relates back to the no theater, because the backdrop of all no stages is painted with a pine tree. So you see, again, how it comes.
So many different layers,
yes.
and symbols.
Yes.
It's incredible. Okay.
Yes, and here we have, again, the no mask, or no men, and this mask is called the Zona, it's for the woman's role. But for me, I was just in shock when I found this picture of Bowie, and to see the similarity in the facial structure and the lips, the setting of the eyes, the nose, and the fact that in traditional Nomen culture with the painting of the eyebrows, that's what those black spots are supposed to signify, because a woman had her eyebrows shaved and at that period, in the Heian period. And so you see this with Bowie. And she doesn't have the kabuki wig, but, you know, it's a no mask. But you can see, I think, the similarities in his sort of, whether it's synchronicitous, but there is a recreation of a no mask in his visage.
And were all no actors men as well? Was there kind of a general ban of women on the stage?
There is. That's changing now, thankfully. I know some no actors who are women. But, yes, the same thing. Mm-hmm. And so, again, they're wearing they're all playing the woman's roles through the use of the mask or the way that they're holding themselves, the carriage, which is also important in kabuki, by the way, the stance, the carriage, the folding of the feet, the hunching of the shoulders. So all of these things to create a sort of androgynous image, I do believe Bowie studied and was perfectly adept at imitating because he had been trained in theater and performance by Lindsay Kemp, who was trained and interested in that himself.
Right.
Yes.
Just
I know.
So many different
I know. It's amazing, isn't it?
Amazing. Yeah, it is. Fantastic.
I love it.
Well, I wanted to move on to kind of the second part of your thesis, really, and talk about the effect on Western fashion that these costumes and these performances had. Could you tell us a bit about
that? I found it most interesting that after Bowie did what he did, this marvelous Japanism and fashion aesthetic for the stage, so many musicians in London from the 70s and 80s on were Japanizing, if you will. There are just a plethora. For example, just a, or even an album cover, such as a group named Sparks. They were based here in London, although they were American. And the album covers call it, the album's called Kimono My House. And there are two women sort of playing a tragicomic geisha, all decked out in kimono. Then you have Freddie Mercury traipsing around on a stage in a kimono. You have Susie Sue of Susie and the Banshees, all in Lloyd Johnson Rising Sun wear. This is more toward the 80s with characters and the Rising Sun flag imagery. Quite spectacular stuff, actually. That was in an exhibition last year at Chelsea Space. Lloyd Johnson's work, just fantastic. And he's still active. He also, in 1973, interestingly, created a jacket, which was in that show, interestingly, at the same time as what was happening with Consign Bowie, all printed with geisha motifs. I want the jacket. And then, it's just Adam Ant with the kabuki makeup. He acknowledges that. I mean, it's just, the list is endless. And the group Japan, of course, with David Sylvian, and Mick Karn, I mean, they were going for that look. So, yeah, it was just a heyday in the music world. And I think that filtered into common consciousness, and that's why then, of course, the triumvirates, people such as Issey Miyake, Yohji Yamamoto, Rei Kawakubo, all of these great Japanese designers, it sort of almost was like they were then entering into the procession. I'm not saying that it was all due to Kansai Bowie's collaboration, but I do think in great part it paved the way for the entrance of the Japanese fashion into the larger fashion world and Western consciousness.
Right. Yeah. Brilliant. Well, I wanted to open the floor to questions shortly. But first of all, I just wanted to ask you what your plans are for the future and where people can find out more about you as
well. Okay, great. Yes, I am currently writing an article for the Japan Times newspaper, which I wrote for many years. And they asked me to write a story on Japanism and Bowie because it's so big now. And so that will happen soon and get printed hopefully before the end of the exhibition on August 11th here. Yeah, there's a book that's going to be published, I don't know, either this year or next year, on the Limerick, Ireland Bowie Symposium, the first one that was held last October, at which I was a speaker. And the essays or papers presented there will be, including mine, in that book. And then, away from Japanism and such, I'm actually wanting to go back to my roots and work on white linen dress history in New Orleans, Louisiana, my home, because that's a tradition of wearing white linen there. And there's a major event every August called White Linen Nights, and I'd like to do White Linen Days and have a symposium and exhibition and local fashion designers using linen as a medium. So I've been researching that the past few months in Germany at the Costume Bibliothek in Berlin.
Excellent. And do you have a website so
yes.
people can find out
yes.
more about you?
Well, for now, it's a Cargo Collective brief thing, but it's www.cargocollective.com/japonicastrasse, JAPONICASTRASSE.
Easy.
So that's about it. Yeah.
Okay. Well, thank you so much.
Thank you.
I wanted to know if there are any questions from the audience on any of the areas we've touched on.
Hey, Paul. Fellow presenter at the Bowie Symposium in Limerick, Ireland. Yeah. Yes.
So was the Japan interaction planned or was it kind of serendipitous just so that the recording can pick up the question as
well? I want to say both. But what I want to say is I do believe that Bowie is very connected to Japan and things Japanese. I mean, really. And I think, again, we can find Lindsay Kemp as a big linchpin in that story. I don't know prior to Lindsay Kemp what interest he had in Japanese things and Japanism, but certainly from that time, it's interesting how meeting Lindsay in the mid-60s, not a few years later, he's working with Kansai, and then we're seeing even in The Man Who Fell to Earth, and this, it's in the exhibition, you could see it, a page from the, handwritten from the script about how he's in the a Japanese hotel or a Japanese restaurant. He even shops at a Japanese friend of mine's store in New York City for decor and such. So, I mean, it's ongoing. And so what I want to say is, yes, I think at base he has that interest, but he's a planner. He's a Capricorn. You know, he's a Capricorn. And a mover and shaker. So I'm not saying that he didn't plan, but I think his interest was there already. And he even admits that, like in a foreword to a book by Mick Rock, which is a fabulous photo book, by the way, if you get a chance to see it, of Bowie photos and other icons of the period, Lou Reed and Lindsay, etc., that was his big influence, Japanese, Lanny Rivas, Dahl, Dada, whomever, Proust. But that he planned it, but it was already initially there in his mind as a seed kernel. And the other thing is that he doesn't leave things to chance, I don't think. And so he is the one who had facilitated, once he heard about it in this fashion show in the Great Gear Trading Company in the King's Road, to get main man to approach Kansai through Yasuko Takahashi about Kansai working with him for the UK 73 tour costumes and subsequent the Aladdin Sane and Ziggy outfits. So, yeah.
Any other questions? Yeah. So throughout your research, did you manage to speak to David Bowie?
He doesn't speak. He doesn't have to. I spoke to him years ago for a long time that evening, and so I think I sort of touched the god. I hope I get to speak to him again. I got to speak with his archive, but that's not speaking with him. But he didn't even communicate, my understanding is, with the museum here. So, yeah.
And anything else? Yep. Oh. So did the Bowie-Yamamoto collaboration have any effect on the fashion that followed, as well as the performance that we covered?
I would say that was also, my answer to that is also synchronicitous. I think there was this driving urge to be more flamboyant from the 80s on, and it's sort of some kind of legacy from the hippie period, insofar as palette, color palettes, and the Peacock Revolution here in London. But I wouldn't say from the research that I did that there was any designer that particularly would attribute their aesthetic or their ethos directly to David Bowie and Yamamoto Kansai. Although now, interestingly, things are seeping out in public forums that, oh, that was always such an influence or that was so interesting. But I never found anything specifically pinpointing that duo as, oh, that informed my design aesthetic. No. But as I say, it definitely influenced musicians and the public at large to get more into Japanese things, turning Japanese, you know, and accepting the other or the exotic East instead of being the yellow peril. Now it's a force for fashionable good. So I would put it on that level. Yeah.
Okay, great. Thank you so much for all of you for coming along. I hope you've enjoyed it as much as I have. It's been fantastic. And mainly, Helene, thank you so much.
Thank you, Amber. Thank you, everybody.